It was a bright June day. The time was 20 years ago. The place was the bureau of B4B of the Office of Reichssicherheit in Berlin. The occasion was an office party. Champagne was uncorked and enjoyed. The reason for the celebration was that the first target in the mission of this office had been achieved. That day it had been officially declared that Fatherland and Austria and the Czech protectorate were Judenrein, combed of the dandruff of Jewish presence. Before the collapse of the Nazi government in 1945, this bureau B4B was to meet another target. One half of its stated mission, to accomplish the final solution to the Jewish problem of Europe, was achieved. One in every two Jews alive on the continent were exterminated. Section B4B was staffed by men from the German civil service. Office deputy was one Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann was not the originator of the program of genocide. That honor, if honor it be, belonged to another Adolf. Nor was he the senior officer in the Reich Security Bureau. Above him were Heydrich and Himmler. Eichmann was the staff officer, the detail officer, if you will, who saw to it from 9 to 5 every day that the trains came to the railroad stations near the ghettos to pick up their human freight. It deposited them on time at the doors of the death camps. It was he who saw to it that the German industrialists who contracted to bring the chemical gases and the cremating ovens to the camps delivered their contracts on time and in good condition. It was he who saw to it that the output, the butchery of the camp, was carried out on time and on schedule. 9 to 5, day in and day out, for the 6 years of the Final Solution project, Eichmann signed the papers and wrote the directives and assigned the officers and the staff, who saw to the elimination of 6 million Jews from the face of the earth. Sixteen years after the collapse of the Nazi government, members of the Israel Security Agency caught up with Eichmann in the Argentine. Now, to Eichmann, his victims were numbers, digits on a carefully ruled ledger paper which was presented to him at his Berlin desk each morning. A ledger which indicated each day's production figures. Production figures which during the years of 1942 and 1943 totaled sometimes more than 50,000 lives a day. To the Israeli security, to Israeli justice, Eichmann was, believe it or not, a man who, like every man, had a right to trial and defense and due process. Instead of shooting him down as the cur that he was in the back streets of Buenos Aires, they brought him to Israel. And for 9 months, he had his day in court. Israel hired and paid for a defense attorney. And only when it was proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that his life was forfeited because he had taken other lives, was his life demanded of him. The 6 million victims gave to Eichmann a justice denied to each and every one of them. And during this trial, worldwide interest was aroused. It seemed for a while as if the wayward and lagging conscience of the world was finally coming awake. Embarrassing questions were asked. Was it really wise to rearm, refashion the Wehrmacht, to put into their hands supersonic planes and submarines capable of delivering atomic potential? Men began to look again at German textbooks. Lo and behold, to no one's surprise, it was found that these by and large avoided any mention of the Hitler period and all mention of German atrocity. And more than this, when they detailed a map of modern Germany in an elementary school geography, there were not two Germanys but one, and not one Germany but a Germany which included much of pre-war Poland to the Oder-Neisse lines. And men began to ask themselves the question, the puzzler. Was Germany repentant, peaceful? Had Germany abandoned its chauvinistic expansion? What were German hopes now that she was rearmed and prosperous and strong again? Had the Allies been wise in their policy of studied forgetfulness? Men wondered. And men recalled that twice in our own century, Germany had been encouraged to rearm to meet an enemy from the east, and that on each previous occasion, it was not the enemy in the east, but Germany which catalyzed war, and the eastern enemy became the wartime ally. Strange things happened during the first year after Eichmann's capture. The NATO powers delayed granting for that year atomic artillery to German forces. For a year, German politicians muted their cries for reunification, and some arrangements were arrived at even in Berlin. The German government convened textbook experts, presumably to revise in a major way the teaching of modern German history in the West German schools. And lo and behold, many of the worst of the Nazi butchers who were living quite openly and peacefully in post-war Germany were arrested, and some were even sentenced to prison. The officer who had managed the gassing of 60,000 at Chelmno was sentenced to 2.5 years in jail with time off for good behavior. 2 years later, today, the diplomats have by and large managed to sweep the world's passions back under the carpet of studied forgetfulness. Things are very much as they were. We hear again of reunification, of the granting of atomic potential to NATO and German troops. The plants of Krupp and Essen are still producing artillery for the nations of the world, quite indiscriminately, and incidentally building up their industrial capacity to produce such artillery for German expansion, when this may be required. And no one bothers to recall to the managers and owners of these plants that during the years 1940 and 45, these same owners ran these plants with Eichmann's victims literally working them to death. The United States, the Soviet Union, the United Arab Republics are all bidding eagerly for the services of German experts in mass butchery, who know how to sophisticate the weapons of human extermination. And German experts, as usual, dispassionately are selling their services to the highest bidder. and incidentally learning of the latest techniques, and they will bring these home. The world looked during the Eichmann trial at a cruel reality, and unable to come to grips with it, backed away. And the cycle of military rearmament and political expansionism and passion, the cycle which reestablishes Germany as the dominant power in Europe, continues, revolves, grows. Personally, the trial of Eichmann was the most staggering event of the last decade. As I looked on this little man in the dock of his Jerusalem trial, I looked in vain for horns. I looked in vain for any evidence of gross mental pathology. I saw instead a man who could quote Kant, who had no moral compunction about his activities, who was a typical civil servant, ordered to do and doing. And I wondered at how many men, how many Eichmanns were busy today, this hour, in our world. How many civil servants in the military and in our industrial plants here and abroad, in the Soviet Union and among her satellites, spend their days as Eichmann did, staffing the paper which refines and improves the techniques, the artistry of human extermination? And how many men have developed all the rationalizations with which Eichmann surrounded himself? It's simply my duty. I'm simply being ordered to do it. If I do not do it, someone else will. I am doing it for my country. I wonder at the conscience of those here and abroad, among our allies and among our enemies, who can daily devote their skills of hand and mind to one single purpose: preparing your grave and mine. They call it playing the war game. The euphemism is carefully chosen. It beclouds the reality. They are playing no game. Ultimately, the order will be given, and then all the rationalizations are there, Eichmann's rationalizations. I was ordered to do it. My loyalty to my nation demanded it. If I did not do it, someone else will. What else could have been done? We deal in Eichmann not with a pathological killer, but with a new type of human being. One who sees nothing evil, nothing inhuman, nothing at all animal and brutal and jungle. In refining the techniques of science and civilization for the destruction of civilization. And there are tens of thousands of Eichmanns at work in our world today. The most tragic factor of it is all is that we have accepted this as the normal pattern of existence. We have fumigated the charnel house. Indeed, we honor these men. We bid for their services. We accept and print their reports. Recently, I picked up one of our national magazines, and there, in one of the center spreads, was a map of our own nation, indicating the major areas of blast and of fallout in the case of a major atomic attack. Indicating what? Your grave and mine. The grave of 100 million Americans. It was printed without passion, without anger, without moral compunction, without moral indignation, between an advertisement for a many-bosomed Hollywood spectacular and an article on high fashion. We have normalized the idea of human butchery. Is this civilization, the 20th century? Recently, an English don, Dr. Alvarez, revisited some of the concentration camps, and he wrote these perceptive comments. At Palmyra, in the forests outside Warsaw, there is a national cemetery for the victim of the Nazi mass executions. Its rows of graves have a certain dignity, and even a certain innocence. Now that trees have grown over the trenches in which the corpses were once piled. But at least those who died at Palmyra were important enough to be singled out. Their deaths were given meaning, and that in turn made some sense of their lives. For everyone, I suppose, believes that death, however haphazard, in a way sums up, even perversely, the inner logic of his personality. That at least within his own tiny circle, his name will survive as history. So the dead at Palmyra have their own graves and their own headstones, and they have become history, national martyrs. But in the 20 months of the executions there, only 1,700 people were killed. The gas chambers at Auschwitz, Birkenau, were designed for 2,000 at a time. They could, in fact, process 40,000 victims a day. Of these, not one was able to vindicate himself as a man. Anyone who even attempted martyrdom, self-sacrifice, or escape endangered the lives of everyone else and so was hated by his fellow prisoners. The final standard of behavior in the camps was the anonymity of bare survival. At that point, death itself is annihilated. The only adequate word is extermination. Instead of names, the victims have numbers. Instead of history, their story is told by statistics. In the last stages, when the crowds and the transports were never registered and their personal documents were destroyed, statistics themselves were inadequate, and oblivion took over. There are, however, no limits to the inflationary spiral of destruction. From 1940 to 1945, nearly 4.5 million people died in Auschwitz alone. The same number would die in minutes if a hydrogen bomb landed on London. The gap is very small between the comforts of our affluent society and the bare animal squalor of Birkenau, or the finality of the Auschwitz crematorium with its rasping iron trolleys. So perhaps the concentration camps have kept a tight hold on our imaginations, not because of some, as some have suggested, that they were the laboratories in which the totalitarian states proved that all things are possible, but because, accepting as we do that all things are now effortlessly possible everywhere, we see them as a small-scale trial run for a nuclear war. Mankind has backed away from this reality presented by the Eichmann trial. Perhaps we cannot come to grips with it. But our Bible commands, and thou shalt burn out the evil from thy midst, to biarta hara mikirbecha. We neither burn nor cauterize, but accept, assimilate, neutralize. The world, by and large, tried to deal with the Eichmann trial not in its implications, but in its complications. It tried to center on the man and his deeds and to avoid the ramifications of his acts. And we had a spate of rather good reporting of the testimony, the prosecution, and the defense, which detailed in gruesome and garish detail the bare facts of Nazi barbarianism. Some strange logic developed in some strange places as to the justice of the Eichmann trial. Cairo Radio developed a unique thesis. According to Cairo Radio, the concentration camps and the death policy were an invention of the Zionist movement. Hitler became the mastermind of the Zionist organization. Why? Because Zionism needed to have death to build up the world's indignation and world support for the establishment of the State of Israel. And strangely, Dr. Servetius, the defense attorney, upon his return to Germany, began to repeat this challenge. I do not mind the thought of Hitler turning over in his grave, but I do mind the slurs attached to this theory. Strangely, among our people, some could not come to grips with the simple reality exposed by the Eichmann trial. For if it made one thing abundantly clear, it was the validity of the Zionist statement. Had there been a State of Israel in 1937 and 1938, when Eichmann's office was to permit the exile, the moving out, the deportation of the Jews from Germany, many more would indeed have been saved. They would not have been met by the high arbitrary quota walls on immigration of the free nations of the West. In 1937 and 38, the Jews of Germany and Austria were caught betwixt and between. Germany wanted them out. England would not permit them into Palestine. We had strict quotas into the United States. No one wanted them in. Zionists have claimed that if there had been a state, if the state could have raised its voice in the Council of Nations and spoken out of the atrocities being committed, London and Washington and the Vatican and the other great powers of our world could not have maintained their studied silence of those years. And there is truth to this statement. And it is true also, as has been shown by a review of Nazi records, that the Nazis were encouraged to speed up their movement from deportation to extermination because of the passivity, the lack of reaction on the part of the West. Now, there have always been those who have not been happy with the proof of this position. Some of these who have always displayed themselves in clothes marked holier than thou, waited until the end of the trial and then set off a series of telegrams to Mr. Ben-Gurion and President Ben-Tzvi, may his memory be for blessing, urging that the death sentence be commuted. One apparently has the right to take 6 million lives without forfeiting his own. New concept in world justice. And strangely, most of these self-proclaimed saints live at peace in the several states of the United States, states which require execution of their convicted murderers, and I have yet to see a single one of them placarding the government's mansion, the dawn on which such a life is being required. Of Israel, we require a saintliness beyond belief. Of ourselves, only the right to require this of Israel. But perhaps the most unkind cut of all, the most unwelcome and the most unnecessary, was the development of an idea given publicity recently in the pages of the New Yorker magazine by an itinerant scholar and writer, Hannah Arendt. Mrs. Arendt, by a strange distress of logic, has in a way made the victims responsible for their own death. Here is her reason. Had the Jews fought back, Germany could not have carried out as efficiently the project of extermination. Why did the Jews not fight back? Because, she claims, the Jewish people of Europe were deliberately misled, misinformed by their communal and religious leaders. Mrs. Arendt was sent or went as a reporter to the Eichmann trial. She had a strange reaction to this trial. She saw Eichmann only as a pathetic human being. And she waxes indignant against the prosecutor, against the presentation of the case, because the prosecutor dared to bring into the four walls of the courtroom the whole circumference of Nazi atrocity. As though the background, the end result of Eichmann's activities had no bearing on his crime. Eichmann himself, she psychoanalyzes, she puts against his pathetic home upbringing, she excuses. The prosecutor, she faults, and faults bitterly. And beyond this, instead of dilating in her articles on Nazi psychology, Nazi brutality, on that blindness of moral sight which permits the taking not only of a single life but of 11 million lives, Jewish and non-Jewish, she dilates upon the guilt of the victims, and she dilates foolishly. Let us examine her position. She first paints the Jew with a yellow badge. Now one wonders where this brave Maccabee was in 1937 and 1938 when Jewish heroism was being demanded. Where was she? Her handbag in hand, escaping to Paris and then to New York. What did she want of these people? That they manned the barricade and 1789 fashion. They spit in the face of the German, that they raised their fist against the Gauleiter. And presumably, had they raised their fists, they would have been saved, or at least not as many would have been killed. Mrs. Arendt, though a social historian, omits a great deal of history. She admits, because she cannot do otherwise, that there was a Warsaw ghetto in which 50,000 Jews with about 12 revolvers, 6 pistols, and 50,000 pairs of fists stood off for 43 days the Nazi might. But she forgets entirely the defense of the ghettos of Lemberg and Tarnopol, of Bialystok and of Bendin, where similar acts of mass heroism took place. Not a mention occurs in her articles of the riots in the death camps of Sobibor and Treblinka, of Majdanek and Bendin, of Chełmno, riots which required the life of every single rioter. Not a mention is made in the article of the 20,000 Jews who joined the Maquis in France, of the 30,000 Jews who took to the hills with the partisans of Yugoslavia, of the Jewish brigades which fought behind the lines of the advancing Allied armies in Italy. No, not one mention of these. She prefers the innocence of her own theory. Let us examine further this theory. Had the Jews fought, they would have survived in greater numbers. 600 of 50,000 survived Warsaw. 6 of 30,000 survived Lemberg. Not a one, not a single Jew who rioted in the death camp survived that riot. Was this the way of survival? Jews survived when they were hidden and protected by kind neighbors as in Holland, when they were welcomed into the guerrilla bands as in Yugoslavia, when they were protected by a morally upright government as in Denmark. Only then did they survive. Jews survived when the Allied advancing armies liberated their lands, their camps. Only then did they survive. Jewish actions had precious little to do with Jewish survival, and that was the tragedy of this whole era and its truth. Jews, she claims further, were misled by their leaders who quieted them, who preached patience and faith when they ought to have been preaching attack. Attack? With what? How does one attack with one's fists a machine gun? Truly, there is no more pathetic sight than the shuffling bands of the millions being taken to the camps. But what shall they do? Dash themselves against those who are marching them off? Their death will be only the more speedy. Shall the husbands desert their families in a vain attempt to escape and leave their families without their one security? Now there were in Europe Jewish ruffians and criminals, and these were artfully selected by the Nazis and put into positions of authority in the camps. And there were among Jewish, pre-war Jewish leaders a few who broke under the urgency of the tension, the pressure, and try to save their own lives at the expense of others. Can we not understand this? Have we not known always and long that our people is like any other people? With its good and its ruffian, with its saintly and its sinner. But to broadcast a charge to blacken the leadership of Germany and of Austria, of Poland and of Hungary, Jews who gave their lives, many of whom who had an opportunity to escape and refused it, to blacken this, blacken the memory of the martyrs is one of the most shameful acts of which one who chose escape and freedom can ever be guilty. Dr. Leo Beck, rabbi in Berlin, liberal rabbi, who was a scholar, man of piety. 1937, again in 1938, again in 1939, he had an opportunity to leave Germany, to escape into freedom, he and his family, and he refused it. He chose to remain with his people. Mrs. Arendt calls Dr. Beck the Jewish Führer. Imagine using this devil's title to brand a saint. And she faults him, along with a number of riffraff whom she cites, for having quieted the people and counseled patience and faith that time alone may heal the wound, the Allies in time may be victorious. What would she have him do? Tell his Sunday school to spill out of a Shabbos morning into the streets and to beat their little fists against some Nazi's chest? Should he have told the widows in his congregation to form a legion with their knitting needles with which to attack? What else could he teach but the immemorial patience and faith of his people? He bargained for time. He gained time. Some escaped. Some made it. Some survived till Allied victory. He gained time because the Nazis were venal, greedy men. They delayed themselves the schedule of Jewish extermination, seeking ransom, booty, holding on to their Jews as a matter of possession, hoping that someone in their family or outside of Germany would pay them a few thousand dollars for this life. Indeed, in patience and delay, there was some small ray of hope. Facts are quite other than those presented to us by Mrs. Arendt. I would deal not with her, but with a larger issue. For she appeals instinctively to an emotion which courses in us. We applaud and have applauded over the past 25 years the renaissance of Jewish virility and courage. Exodus, Mila 18, and the Wall. These have been our idols and idols. We are free. We are protected by a vast army. We are citizens, masters of our own destiny. We can move about freely. We are proud of that freedom. We are proud that we no longer need to restrain ourselves, bridle our speech, be careful of our politics, manage ourselves as inferiors because we are segregated as such. And we respond to physical abandon, to physical courage, to moral bravery. But is that the only form of courage? I read to you brief paragraphs written by one of Eichmann's own commandos. This is not literature, but biography. Not written by a friend, but by an enemy. The people who had got off the trucks, men, women, and children of all ages, had to undress upon the order of an SS man who carried a riding or dog whip, put down their clothing in fixed places, sorted according to shoes, top clothing, and underclothing. I saw a heap of shoes of about 800 to 1,000 pairs, great piles of under linen and clothing. Without screaming or weeping, these people undressed, stood around in family groups, kissed each other, said their farewells, and waited for a sign from another SS man who stood near the pit, also with a whip in his hand. No complaints or pleas for mercy were heard. A family of about 8 persons passes by, a man and a woman, both about 50, with their children of about 1, 8, and 10, and 2 grown-up daughters of 20 and 24. An old woman with snow-white hair was holding the 1-year-old child in her arms, singing to it and tickling it. The child was cooing with delight. The couple was looking on with tears in their eyes. The father was holding the hand of the 10-year-old boy and speaking to him softly. The boy was fighting back his tears. The father pointed towards the sky, stroked his head, and seemed to explain something to him. At that moment, the SS man at the pit shouted something to his comrade. The latter counted off about 20 persons and instructed them to go behind the pit. Among them was the family I mentioned. I need not read of the extermination. I read of the courage. What is courage? The father who futilely makes a brave gesture, hopeless, and abandons his family to sadistic torture? Or the father who remains strong, reaching his hand to the heavens, drawing down from God faith and strength and courage for the moment of truth? There is courage. Courage of the highest, most profound order. Courage which complements the bravery of battle. and complements it beautifully. Courage which imposes upon us obligation. For we recite and rehearse not these horrors simply to heat up our emotions. There is no point in reliving the bloodlust of the past, except to be more determined and energetic in the present. We are the survivors. We are the inheritors. What have we inherited? Obligation. A simple truth. Our lives cannot be routine. They cannot be non-political. They cannot be non-principled and unpassioned. We must see to it that such murderous times never recur. We must see it that the preparing tragedy of our day never comes about. We cannot be satisfied with empty words and half-meant promises. We must be men of action, of courage, of principle, worthy of inheriting this precious legacy. Amen.